Nuclear cancer. It's a well-established scientific fact that exposure to radiation can cause cancer, and that radiation from all aspects of the nuclear fuel chain, from uranium mining to manufacturing sites to reactors to waste, release potentially dangerous levels of radiation into the environment. But how dangerous is it? The government doesn't test for it, so they can't tell us other than assuring us that, yes, everything is A-OK, don't worry your pretty little head about it. But when a contaminated, defunct nuclear manufacturing site, the former Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant in Piketon, Ohio, is poised to once again become a nuclear hub, with the launch of a uranium enrichment plant on that radioactively contaminated site, and local people need facts and data to back up their protests, they turn to a genuine expert with decades of experience crunching the medical statistics to find the patterns and pictures of what's really going on. And he tells you,
in the 30 plus years that our group has been doing these studies, we found high rates of cancer and other diseases near nuclear plants in most cases, but the excesses near Portsmouth are the highest excess cancers and death rates I have seen in any nuclear plant in the U.S.
Well, when epidemiologist Joe Mangano of Radiation and Public Health Project explains what the numbers show from the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant and warns of the ongoing and increasing risk to people in and around Pike County, Ohio, and he has got the numbers to back it up, you see how the nuclear industry and those who enable it have absolutely no concern for the safety of people and the environment, and they are pushing to expand that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we learn about the deadly radiological legacy of the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant in Piketon, Ohio. We talk with Joe Mangano. He's head of Radiation and Public Health Project, an epidemiologist who is best known for his work on the baby tooth study, which found alarming levels of radioactive strontium-90 in baby teeth after the U.S. atmospheric bomb tests. And he's been called on to determine levels of the health impact in the 7 counties around Pike County in Ohio. His findings deserve to be alarming to anyone who lives in the area and anyone who is pushing for this nuclear hub to move forward. And this week we celebrate because it's the 700th episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. We mark this occasion with a lot of woo-hoos, but also the launch of a new campaign for 2025. #Nuclear80. We'll explain all about it during Activist Shoutout. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, the return of Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and more honest nuclear information than will probably ever be discussed by the incoming president's cabinet. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, November 19, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S. in California, generative AI will be deployed at Diablo Canyon for the first time ever at a nuclear power station. According to owners Pacific Gas and Electric, the AI will transform document search and retrieval and deliver significant cost trainings, while at the same time, and here I quote, eventually play a more direct role in nuclear plant construction and operations. AI in charge of nukes. What could go wrong? The system is set to begin in early 2025. Meanwhile, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has intoned that there will be no significant environmental impacts from allowing Diablo Canyon's spent fuel storage to operate for another 40 years. Which leads us to ask, what are those people drinking, smoking, or injecting? Last Friday, November 15th, the St. Lucie 1 nuclear reactor in Florida scrammed, meaning it shut down on an emergency basis, at 100% power. Three control element assemblies, which are critical parts, accidentally dropped all the way into the core, possibly due to an electrical failure. In the words of Edwin Lyman, head of nuclear safety for the Union of Concerned Scientists, not good. In New York State, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says a small nuclear reactor would be the optimal option to supply the energy needs at Fort Drum. But now a University of Texas at Austin professor cautions against using nuclear power to provide electricity to military bases, saying it is not worth the risk. Dr. Alan J. Cooperman, an expert on nuclear proliferation, said, "I can guarantee energy resiliency can be done cheaper with solar and wind combined with batteries. Nuclear still requires off-site batteries because reactors do not generate their own electricity. They pull it from the grid. So if the grid goes down, the nuclear power can't operate and you lose energy resilience." The New York Times new nuclear reporter, W.J. Hennigan, in an article entitled "The Price," followed a class of fifth grade students at Preston Veterans Memorial School in Preston, Connecticut, to look at a six-week course being taught to them, 10 and 11-year-olds, by the defense contractor General Dynamics. When one precocious 10-year-old was asked why the class was being taught, she said, "Because you're building submarines and you, like, need people, and you're teaching us about it in case we're interested in working there when we get older." She nailed it. The U.S. Navy has put together an order for General Dynamics to produce 12 nuclear ballistic missile submarines by 2042, a job that's projected to cost $130 billion. The industry is struggling to find the tens of thousands of new workers it needs. So for the past 18 months, the company has traveled to elementary schools across New England to educate children in the basics of submarine manufacturing and perhaps inspire a student or two to consider one day joining its shipyards. An add-on to the annual late October Nuclear Science Week, which goes to schools around the country with comic books on how wonderful nuclear is. Indoctrinate them early and never give them the chance to hear an opposing voice. Now, here once again with one of my favorite opposing voices is Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
It's hard to know where to begin in light of all that has happened since I was last on the air here back in late September. So I suppose I should begin with a question. How are you all doing? Not so great? That's understandable. Ready to fight back? That's commendable. Personally, I've always been a get up, stand up kind of person. If we don't fight for our rights and for what's right, who will? At the moment, though, I feel rather more sit down, give up, and definitely pretty battle scarred. There are only so many demonstrations you can go on, articles you can write, and lobbying of reluctant Congress members you can do without starting to feel a little defeated. Not that on our issue, at least, there's ever much hope on Capitol Hill. When it comes to calling out the ills of nuclear power, there are only two consistent voices, joined here and then by others, yes, but consistent voices, and they belong to Senators Ed Markey and Bernie Sanders. Who is in charge in the White House and on Capitol Hill, therefore, unfortunately doesn't change much when it comes to nuclear power policy, since it's pretty much all fission-powered systems go for nuclear, no matter which side of the aisle you are talking to. But it will change things when it comes to salvaging at least some modicum of safety oversight and regulation. Those regulations are needed, however compromised, to try to prevent the unthinkable, a serious nuclear power accident, from becoming inevitable. Granted, we already have a pretty lapdog regulator in the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but now there are some serious moves afoot to gut what little safety oversight that agency still might exercise. The NRC, we are told, must be modernized. But what does that word mean? It means emasculated. It means streamlining and fast-tracking new reactor applications and even the license renewals for old ones to bypass those annoying stumbling blocks like safety and security. It means completely disregarding the likely effects of an increasingly more violent climate on the safe operations of existing and planned new reactors. It's full speed ahead and damn the tornadoes and hurricanes, sea level rise, flash floods and forest fires. To get this done, the five commissioners at the NRC need to be yes men and occasionally women who won't throw any obstacles in the industry's path that could slow its expansion ambitions. So, sitting Commissioner Jeff Barron, a Democratic appointee, found himself dismissed. Biden withdrew his renomination after he had suggested in his renomination hearing that perhaps he ought to be allowed to focus on nuclear safety and security, and that he should not be asked to weigh in on the pros and cons of the merits of nuclear power. Now we have the candidacy of Matthew Marzano, another Biden nomination for the open fifth chair on the NRC commission. In September, Marzano endured a grueling 90-plus minute interrogation by the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, during which he was confronted by accusations that if selected, he would be, quote, the least qualified commissioner ever seated on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then there was no vote, and no explanation why not. The new vote was pushed to November 13th, but it didn't happen. Again, there was no explanation. But Marzano, like Barron, also rashly emphasized the need for safety oversight when he told the committee that, quote, the benefits that nuclear power can bring and the public license that nuclear has currently can only be realized if it is operating safely. For Republicans, at least, that was a no-no, despite the fact that the NRC's own mission is, quote, protecting people and the environment, but probably not anymore. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Over to Japan, where that country's nuclear watchdog, the Nuclear Regulatory Authority, has formally disqualified the Tsuruga No. 2 reactor as unfit to be restarted, as its operator failed to address safety risks stemming from the presence of possible active fault lines, which could potentially cause earthquakes underneath it. But the Onagawa nuclear reactor in Miyagi Prefecture in northeast Japan has now resumed power generation for the first time since the Fukushima nuclear disaster in March of 2011. It was originally reactivated on October 29, but halted on November 4 when a problem was found in instrumentation. In Ukraine, the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant has once again come close to a blackout, with one of its two remaining power supply lines disconnected. If the remaining line is lost, Zaporizhzhia will face a complete blackout, a severe violation of safety conditions with the potential to trigger an accident. On November 14, Russia's foreign ministry warned that it can expel International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors from Zaporizhzhia if it finds their work, quote, inappropriate, end quote, saying that the inspectors are there, quote, only with the consent of the government of the Russian Federation. In response, Ukraine has spoken out to claim it could be months away from building a nuclear bomb, with a new report claiming that it would be not difficult to use spent nuclear fuel from its nine power plants to create a rudimentary atomic device. At the COP29 UN Climate Change Conference taking place in Baku, Azerbaijan, six more countries have added their support for the tripling of global nuclear energy capacity by 2050. During COP28, held in Dubai last year, 25 countries backed a ministerial declaration calling for a tripling of global nuclear energy capacity by 2025. Here's the rub. The declaration says the countries recognize the need for a tripling of nuclear energy capacity to achieve, and here I quote, global net zero greenhouse gas carbon neutrality by or around mid-century. The nuclear industry's definition of carbon neutrality refers only to the instant that an atom is split and releases its energy. In that split of a split of a split of a second, it is true that there are no carbon emissions. But one has to draw back from that very narrow focus to look at the entire nuclear fuel chain, from uranium transport to refining to building the fuel rods to building the reactors to transport between all of those locations, and then add in, oh yes, the radioactive waste and storing it for 250,000 years. There is no way that that weight is not carbon intensive. The nuclear industry doesn't want you to look beyond that little teeny tiny narrow focus. But that's because to do so would show that their entire strategy for convincing us that we need more nukes is based upon a lie, actually many lies. Complicity around the push for more countries to sign on was revealed at an event that was co-sponsored at COP29 by the presidency of COP29. The International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, which is supposed to be the UN watchdog on nuclear issues, the United States, and the propagandizers-in-chief, the World Nuclear Association. That is where El Salvador, Kazakhstan, Kenya, Kosovo, Nigeria, and Turkey signed on and joined their nuclear brethren from countries including Canada, France, Japan, South Korea, the UAE, the UK, and the good old US of A. What none of those countries realize is that the bright, shiny object of nuclear with all its promises will turn into the yoke around their necks from which they can never escape because of the need to manage the radioactive nuclear waste that results and the need for the nuclear industry to be the ones in charge of how that gets done. It's forced international alliance based on each country's enslavement to nuclear. In Finland, the newest and most powerful nuclear reactor in Europe that was delivered more than a decade late and nearly four times over budget is also proving to be a headache for grid operators now that it's finally up and running. Sort of. On Sunday, November 17, Olkiluoto 3 nuclear reactor tripped again, meaning it broke down again, the latest in a series of faults and outages that have plagued the new facility and caused the market to reach out for backup power to fill the gap. This time, a turbine malfunction in the generator's seal oil system was to blame. And of course, the repair, quote-unquote, is taking longer than expected. Isn't it interesting that the nuclear lobby likes to claim that renewable sources such as wind and solar require backup, while nuclear does not, when clearly it does? And now back to Ukraine, where the area around the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, which exploded and created the worst nuclear accident on the planet so far, Chernobyl is one of the places being looked at as potential locations for Ukraine's planned future wave of small modular nuclear reactors. No mention of the fact that the area around the Chernobyl accident is still so radioactive, there's a 30-mile exclusion zone where people aren't allowed unless they are officially there to do maintenance or protection on the site. One of their plans is to build a pilot plant to demonstrate production of clean hydrogen and ammonia, quote, using simulated safe and secure small modular reactor technology. Well, it has to be simulated. The technology does not exist. There are no small modular nuclear reactors available. And as for safe and secure, that's always simulated with nuclear. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, happy anniversary to us! This is Nuclear Hot Seat's 700th episode. If you'd told me back when I started the show on June 14, 2011, that I'd be hitting this milestone, I would have thought you nuts. But one week at a time, one episode at a time, for 700 weeks, we stuck to it. For 13 and a half years, this show has been telling the story of the nuclear industry and the brave, brilliant activists, scientists, engineers, and occasionally politicians who oppose it. Stories have played out in bite-sized chunks and ongoing sagas as we shout at the nuclear lemmings, "Stop! That's a cliff! And you're heading over it! And you're taking us with you!" The jury's still out on whether they'll hear us and respond in time. But I plan to stick with this story as long as my health and the laws of the land allow. So how about some love? Yes, a round of applause is always appreciated, but the acknowledgement we most need would be a donation to help us with our expenses. This show has never accepted ads. We have no underwriting, no sponsors, no grants. So the continuation of Nuclear Hot Seat is all on you, the listeners. And we need your help. So won't you join us now? Consider a donation a reward for a job well done, or a holiday gift, be it a one-time donation of any size or a recurring monthly donation of as little as $5. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so your donation is tax deductible. You can make it by going to nuclearhotseat.com and clicking on the red button, or you can send a donation through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Be it the commemoration of our 700th episode, the holidays, or just your interest in cutting-edge information on nuclear issues, celebrate with us by helping us to continue to help you. NuclearHotSeat.com, and whatever you can do to help, you've got my gratitude. Now here's this week's featured interview. The country is gearing up to turn Pike County, Ohio, into what they're calling a nuclear hub, starting with the launch of a uranium enrichment plant in the United States, the first one in almost 70 years. The last one was also on the same site in Piketon. It's still radioactive, part of a multi-decade cleanup that is only just getting started. And all this, even as a new facility, will contaminate even more of the land and the people. But how bad is it? To learn the facts, I spoke with Joe Mangano. He is a health researcher who has served with Radiation and Public Health Project since 1989. Mangano managed the study of strontium-90 in baby teeth and is author or co-author of 33 medical journal articles on radiation health. His books include Low-Level Radiation and Immune System Damage, an Atomic Era Legacy, and Radioactive Baby Teeth, The Cancer Link. He is featured in the documentary Silent Fallout, Baby Teeth Speak, which covers the Cold War era study of atomic bomb radiation in 320,000 baby teeth collected by St. Louis area scientists. As you will hear, Joe has been crunching the health statistics on cancer in Pike and surrounding counties since 2021, and has now published his third report on cancer rates in the areas adjacent to the defunct but being resurrected Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant. I spoke with Joe Mangano on November 15, 2024. Joseph Mangano, it is always great to have you here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's always great to be here, Libby.
As an epidemiologist, explain to the listeners what you do and why you do it, what it is meant to achieve.
An epidemiologist is a fancy word for health statistician, okay? What an epidemiologist does is analyze trends and patterns of disease and death rates in a particular area and over time. It's as simple as that.
What has been your interest in the area around the Piketon Gaseous Diffusion Plant in Ohio, and how long have you been working on it?
My odyssey with Piketon began in the summer of 2022 when I got a phone call from members of the ONFN, Ohio Nuclear Free Network. They're a citizens-based group concerned about Portsmouth and other nuclear facilities in Ohio. What they asked me to do was to do a report on the patterns of disease rates and trends of disease rate near Portsmouth. And since then, I have produced three reports, 2022, 23, and just now, November 2024.
What was the nature of their concern in wanting you to check these statistics?
Well, their concerns really are typical of what happens near a nuclear plant. The concerns begin not from the top, but from the grassroots. People expressing beliefs that there are an exceptionally large number of cancers in the area or people who are dying. That has occurred in near Portsmouth for a long time. More recently, the next step was taken to see how much of this radioactivity was actually in the environment. And that led to studies by Dr. Michael Ketterer, who's a chemistry professor from Northern Arizona University. He found near the plant and even in the counties beyond that, levels of radioactivity, such as plutonium, neptunium, uranium, and several others.
These are all radioactive elements.
These are all highly radioactive elements that last forever in the world. Then the third step, the third question really comes down to, okay, we believe there's a lot of cancer in the area, and we know that there's radioactivity in the air. Is this real? And that's when they turned to me. And what I did was essentially use the CDC's website. They keep a nice annual list of mortality in the U.S. every year from 1968 to 2023. And analyze the trends in cancer and other diseases.
What is it that you found?
First report was late 2022. That focused strictly on Pike County. Pike County is the location of Portsmouth. It is a small county, mostly consisting of rural areas and small towns. The population is about 27,000. It is a generally low socioeconomic area. Poverty rate is high. The unemployment rate is high. Percent without any access to medical care is high. Education rates are lower, and so on. So I went into it expecting to find rates that are higher than, say, the United States average.
And when you say rates, you're talking about cancer rates?
Cancer rates and rates of mortality, death rates, from all causes combined. Sometimes cancers aren't always coded as cancer, so I think it's important to do both. And here's what I found. The first thing is really going back to 1950. For a long time, the Pike County cancer death rate was below the U.S., about 12% below the U.S. in the 1950s and 1960s. You would expect that because it wasn't the home to any great polluting industries. However, as time went on, the low cancer rate county became a high cancer rate county. The mortality at last count for all people was about 33% above the United States. That's a big difference. I also found out that death rates for all causes combined, for a long time, the county's death rate was 10 or 15% above the U.S. And this is through the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, early in the operation of Portsmouth. And that wasn't a surprise. In a county that is poor, that doesn't have great access to health care and so on, that is something that you would expect. However, in addition, I found that the death rate for all people from all causes, people under 75 years old, we would call this the premature death rate. For a long time, when the plants opened, it was about 10 or 15% above the U.S., which is understandable. But beginning about 40 years ago, that 10% rate grew steadily until now. Premature death rate is 107% above the U.S. rate, more than double the U.S., one of the highest rates of any of the thousands of U.S. counties. That is a very, very important finding. So important that second report that I did addressed two questions. One question is, well, maybe this is just Appalachia. Maybe it's just the fact that it's a poor area. And the other issue is, well, is it only Pike County or does it go further? What I did was to take the 7-county area around Portsmouth, including Pike County, the 7 counties, Adams, Galea, Jackson, Lawrence. All of these counties are kind of like Pike County, rural, small towns, poor. And I compared their premature death rate with other Ohio poor counties that are much further away from Portsmouth. And there's been an increase in premature death rates. In the area near Portsmouth, it is much, much greater, much more rapid. The gap is growing between poor counties near Portsmouth and four counties far from Portsmouth. It is not just Appalachia.
What does this speak to, and how alarming is it?
It speaks to the fact that these dangerous radioactive chemicals were not just produced, but released into the environment and were ingested by humans through breathing and the food chain, a combination of the two. There's been some discussion about this. There's no way of knowing exactly how much is breathed in or from the food chain, but that's how any kind of radiation from any nuclear plant is taken in the human body. And once in the human body, we know that these chemicals damage cells, destroy cells, leading to higher risk of diseases such as cancer, birth defects, and other conditions. There can be other reasons why these rates are so high, but there's nothing obvious other than poverty, which has been the case in the area for a long time. Nothing's really changed. It was poor years ago, and it's still poor. But what has changed is the addition of this large toxic plant.
So Pike County seems to be the epicenter of this problem, but it has radiated out to the surrounding counties. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Couldn't it be that they're smoking more cigarettes, or the food has been degraded, or microparticles of plastic or cow farts, any of the things that the establishment likes to blame health problems on? Could any of that, other than radiation, be responsible for this dramatic a shift?
In theory, other things could account for this. And in report one, I included statistics on several of the potential factors. For example, the smoking rate among adults in Pike County is 27%. In the state of Ohio, it's 22%. Pike County is higher, but not much higher, and that certainly couldn't account for this tremendous gap in local rates versus the U.S. And the same with other factors as well.
The Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant was shut down. It's been dismantled. The Environmental Protection Agency says it's being cleaned up and they're doing things there. However, there are now plans in place and moving forward, they're in the process of being instituted for what's being called the Southern Ohio Diversification Initiative, which is redevelopment of the former Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant so that it can process a new type of radioactive fuel that's specifically intended for small modular nuclear reactors, a technology that doesn't yet exist but is being moved towards on many levels. With them planning to reactivate this plant, are there more protections in place for the people in the area, or is this going to continue to add on to the burden of radiation contamination that they've already been subjected to?
It's unfortunate to say that while there are protections in nuclear plants against the harmful effects of exposures, there has never been any regulation or any mandate to monitor how much radiation is being absorbed by workers and by local residents, and no regulation that insists that health studies be done, monitoring of health trends in the local population be done. What was used in its place was what is called permissible limits. The operator of every nuclear plant is obliged every year to report to the government how much radiation has been released into the environment and how much is in the environment itself, the levels in water and soil and air and so on. If levels are below what the government says is a permissible limit, not only can the company keep their license and keep running the reactor, but they take the big jump of saying that the reactor is being run safely. You cannot assume safety just because there are low levels. Smoking is harmful. We know that. Smoking four cigarettes a day is better than smoking two packs a day. However, You cannot make the jump to the conclusion that four cigarettes a day are safe. Okay, you have to do the studies first, and that's where the problem is. There is no effort to do any studies.
And is there any overseeing of these companies coming up with the statistics as to what the radiation release rate is and what the possible contamination rate is? Is there any oversight to make certain that the numbers they are providing are accurate?
These numbers are all self-reported. The company that runs the plant measures how much is being released and measures how much is in the environment. And the government regulators accept them and say, okay, thank you very much. We look forward to next year's report.
So there are no checks and balances on it?
No. When I say radioactivity, we're talking not about one type of isotope or chemical, but many, many different ones. Okay, I just named a couple like plutonium and various forms of uranium and so on. The measurements are limited. They don't measure every single one. And they're often just measured like once a year or once a quarter.
What does this mean, especially with the Portsmouth plant being reactivated now? What does this mean in your estimation for the people who live in the immediate area?
We need to translate these findings into public policy. Any business, any operation must not be harming people living nearby. And more than that, there needs to be proof that their operations are safe. Maybe we need more studies beyond the ones that I've been able to do. But you cannot just assume that the plant has been run safely and go ahead and build new nuclear facilities and start operating them and add more of these dangerous, I mean, really the most toxic, poisonous chemicals in our world into the environment and the bodies of people who are already suffering at very, very high levels. Their death rates are way higher than they should be for an area like this.
Has the government done any studies of the population, what the impact of this radiological contamination might be?
The federal government has only done one study of cancer near nuclear plants in the almost 70 years that they've been running. It was done in the late 1980s. It was done only at the insistence of Senator Edward Kennedy, and obviously now is outdated. It only used information up to the 1980s. Interestingly, Pike County was included in that report. Otherwise, there are no, again, without any rules or mandates to do studies, they just don't do them. And our group has received extensive criticism from government agencies about our methods, about our conclusions.
What are the complaints and what's the validity of them?
The complaint is basically, you have to be wrong because below a certain level, radiation is safe. And there is absolutely no proof that any dose of radiation is safe. Yes, the smaller the dose, the less harmful it is. However, there is no safe dose of radiation, which is not just my opinion or our group's opinion, but it is the conclusion of scientists way back in 1990, something called the Beer 5 report. The National Academy of Sciences looked at hundreds of studies and found that even at low levels, there was harm. So that flies in the face of science. But reactors such as Portsmouth cannot operate without releasing some of these toxic chemicals into the environment. So there's an issue here, not just legal, but moral to do so, knowing that some of this is going to be released and harm people, especially young people. You know, the exposures to the fetus and the infant and the young child are much worse than the adult exposures.
And we also know that radiation is twice as harmful to women as to men and little girls than to little boys. We know that from the work of Mary Olson with Gender and Radiation Impact Project. And that's all been verified.
Yes, there are a number of studies that Mary looked at that came to the same conclusion.
You have just recently come up with this 2023 report and released it. What has been done to publicize it? And what, if anything, has happened in the media as a result?
The most recent study was released in November 2024. It is posted on our website, radiation.org, and it inspired several TV reports across the state of Ohio. There were six CBS affiliates that produced 2 5-minute reports, November 4 and November 5, about the findings and about individual cases of people with cancer in the area and what they thought about their cancer and where it came from. And to a man, everyone said that they felt the plant was the major culprit.
Has there been any governmental response to this?
There has been no response, not just to the November 2024 study, to any of my three studies the last 3 years. It seems like in earlier times, there was more hard feedback from them, but now generally silence is what occurs, and they just proceed with their plans to build new nuclear facilities at the site.
What, if anything, can be done for the people and can be done to slow down, stop, mitigate this radiological contamination, this tsunami growing of radiological contamination to protect the people in the local area?
Unfortunately, the change comes from the bottom up, not from the top down. We cannot expect our leaders in the industry that is running the plant, or in the government regulators, in this case, the Department of Energy, to safely protect people from the harm of radiation. So it is important that grassroots groups, such as press or Don't Dump on Us, these are run by local citizens who have lived near the plant all their lives, have worked in plant, know people that have worked there, and know lots and lots of people with cancer and other diseases as well. The only way we can get any change to better protect people is for them to tell their story and tell it to the media and tell it to the political leaders that have the power to stop any new nuclear facilities from being built at the plant. Unfortunately, we cannot go back into the past. We cannot undo what's been done already. The damage has been done. But what we can do is to influence the future in a positive way.
If listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat would want to be of assistance on this, what would you suggest they do?
There's several things they can do. One is to go to our website, radiation.org, and read the reports and view the TV stories about the problems of health near Portsmouth. They can reach out to groups like Ohio Nuclear Free Network and press and Don't Dump on Us and volunteer their services and reach out to their representatives in the House, in the Senate, in the White House, and at the state level as well, because they play a role in ensuring the safety of Ohio residents.
And what, if any, position do you anticipate having as this moves forward? Having just completed 2023, will you be looking at 2024 statistics?
Oh, yes. These are the most current statistics. 2024 is still not finalized, but oh, yes. The monitoring that our group is doing is really something that health departments should be doing all along. And that's to monitor these trends and to act on them when, as I said, the death rate prematurely in Pike County is more than double the United States and one of the highest in the country. This is just the first step to do some studies.
In all the work I've done on Nuclear Hot Seat, one consistent fact that comes out is that the government doesn't follow up on any of these circumstances to do a study, because if there is data, we can have the basis for our complaints. We can be backed up by it. So with no data, there's nothing that we can use to prove unless we generate it ourselves.
Information is power, Louie. And in this case, information comes really from two sources. You have individuals, as we've seen in the recent CBS TV pieces in Ohio, giving their stories. Yes, I know lots and lots of people with cancer, much more than I did years ago. That's one side. And then the other side is what our group does. We can provide the analysis of official data to verify, yes, in fact, there is a high level of cancer. And I should say, of other diseases. It's not just cancer. In the last 3 years, 21, 22, and 23, the highest excesses in premature deaths in Pike County are mostly lung diseases. That includes lung cancer, COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, influenza, pneumonia, and now COVID-19. The rates for Pike County are about three times, about triple what the US rate is. The only other causes of premature death that are up there are heart attacks, acute myocardial infarction, and the other one is drug overdoses, which is something that is not a result of any releases from Portsmouth, but from social conditions. And the thing is that lung diseases need more study, more review, because, as I said, way humans take in these chemicals into their body is either by the food chain or by breathing. Okay? And by breathing, they get into the into people's lungs, where they cause terrible damage to cells. These statistics should be a red flag, an alarm bell to go off to find out more and the relation with radiation.
Is there anything we haven't touched upon that you would like to bring up now?
Just a statement. In the 30 plus years that our group has been doing these studies, we found high rates of cancer and other diseases near nuclear plants in most cases. But the excesses near Portsmouth are the highest excess cancers and death rates I have seen in any nuclear plant in the US.
Joe Mangano, the work of radiation and public health has been so important to our understanding of exactly what we face, and quantifying it using statistics that are out there, whether the government and whether the nuclear entities like it or not. For the work you do, I thank you. And of course, I thank you for once again being my very gracious and informative guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for all the good work you do.
That was Joe Mangano, epidemiologist and head of radiation and public health project at radiation.org. We will link to his page that presents his three published reports on cancer rates around the Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant, dealing with 2021, 22, and 23. You'll find that link on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 700.
Activists, shout out.
A reminder that the link to our contact page at nuclearhotseat.com was unfortunately out of commission without us knowing it for quite a while. It has been repaired. You can now contact us. Just fill out the form. Promise I'll get back to you. The BBC documentary, Britain's Nuclear Bomb Scandal, Our Story, is now available online in its entirety. This is the story of Britain's post-war atomic weapons program, its devastating legacy for the thousands of service personnel who took part, and the impact on their families and Indigenous communities. We mentioned the show's preview last week, and now the full film is up and available, and we strongly recommend it. The link will be on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 700. And we're also linking to an extraordinary article by physicist Linda Williams. It's entitled Nuclear Propaganda Exposed: The Dirty Truth Behind Government and Industry Claims. It is clear, concise, easy to understand, brilliantly well written, and we're working to get Linda to join Nuclear Hot Seat's roster of outside commentators because reports like this are as good as they get. And of course, you can click on the link on our website. Now, here's the launch of what I hope will prove to be an exciting new program to promote all the voices that oppose nuclear and make it a worldwide simultaneous shout out. 2025 marks the 80th anniversary of the start of the atomic age and all the ensuing nuclear madness. We already know that the media is going to make a thing out of this because it's an anniversary that ends in a zero. And you can bet The nuclear propaganda machine is already gearing up to deluge the media with op-eds, talking points, junkets, articles, and junk to drown out our voices that oppose them. That's why we need to be proactive and take control of the narrative, starting now. Here's my proposal. While there are many well-established protocols and ceremonies for commemorating the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, far less attention is given to the world's first atomic bomb blast, the test at the Trinity site in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. It is commemorated in New Mexico by groups such as the Tularosa Basin Downwinders, headed by Tina Cordova, and other groups, which draw attention to downwinder issues. But it is sadly under-acknowledged in the larger international nuclear community. All nuclear, no matter what your issue, stems from this first atomic blast. So my proposal is that we, the international community of those who oppose nuclear in all forms, utilize this anniversary to bring attention to whatever issues are most important to you and your community. Uranium mining, contaminated radioactive sites, reactors, weapons, waste, transport, downwinders and hibakusha, cancer rates in children, whatever your nuclear focus, bring attention to it. Aim for July 16, 2025, the anniversary, or because it's on a Wednesday, any time during the week of Friday, July 11 to Sunday, July 20th, 2025. What you do can take any form, a ceremony of mourning, protests, rallies, marches, art and music, activism of any kind. Base it in your own culture, your own idioms, your own local concerns. I personally would love to see the Maori people come up with an anti-nuclear haka against the bombings that were done in the South Pacific. Or for Broadway people to come up with at least a scene, if not a song. It can be as simple as a single person standing on a street corner with a sign that says, "No nukes." However you wish to and are able to communicate the start of this nuclear madness and your opposition to it, do so. There is one additional thing to do that will unify us as we take this action. A hashtag. Whatever you post online or put in press releases or articles or write on signs, use hashtag nuclear8080. This way, an online search will allow us to find each other. And the media will be able to find us, and not just one or two, but all of us. It matters not what you do, just do something and post about it. Show your progress, your wins, people involved, what your issues are. Use this as an opportunity to communicate. We are stronger together than we can possibly be apart. And by making this into a week-long acknowledgement of the start of the nuclear nightmare, what it has led to, and what we wish to do about it, we make it a thing that the media can latch onto, hopefully promoting extensive coverage from our perspective for a change. My vision is an international coordination of anti-nuclear voices sweeping around the world, pointing out that the issues, the countries, the people, are not isolated in our own separate silos, but that we are part of something larger and truly international, planet-wide. The chorus of voices that say no to nuclear. No, it is not clean, green, or carbon-free, and no, it is not the solution to climate change. The mistakes we are making with it now will plague people and the planet for as long as there is life on Earth. I've been reaching out to individuals and groups quietly, and the process has begun. I'm still working out the social media steps we need to take and the tools we need to use, and I'm open to your input and expertise on this. Anything you can think of to help us get the word out and coordinate our voices will help. So let us know about any action you choose to take by sending an email, for now, to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Next year represents an enormous opportunity to counter nuclear industry propaganda and make our needs, concerns, and vision known. We have to take control of the narrative. And the way to start is with the tag, #nuclear80. Any questions or thoughts? Send them to me in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And let's get busy. After all, July 16 is only 240 days away. We've got some work to do. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 19, 2024. Hey, don't miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat because there's always more nuclear news that you're not hearing anywhere else. We make it easy. Of course, it's available on all your favorite podcast platforms, but the best for us is if you go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big honking yellow box that pops up. You can't miss it. If you put in your first name and an email address and send that to us, we can then send you every week one, count them, one and only one email with a link to that week's show and a bit of information about what's included. That way, you will never be out of the nuclear loop. You'll always have access to the episode. And by signing up this way, we get to put you on the database, which means that Google algorithms respect us even more, and we move up in the ranking so more people can find us. So do it that way if you can, please. More audience participation. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, especially in light of episode number 700 and the holidays coming up, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. And as always, we will have gratitude and really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Hardestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that when it comes to nuclear, not only can what you don't know hurt you, chances are that it already has. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep. Because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.